And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM. And we've got an action-packed program for you today, a full hour of new content, new programming. It's going to be great. We're starting out with Sarah Hipworth. We're going to be looking at the latest from the War Resisters Support Campaign. That's coming right up. Following that, at the half-hour mark, we're going to be looking at a documentary about a Toronto-based professor who passed away. It's about the life of David Noble. And we're going to be speaking with Jonathan Bullock on that after 5:30. But first, let's go over to our live in-studio interview. We have Sarah and Doug with us today. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Pleased to be here, Brendan.
Well, we're looking at an issue that we have been covering constantly on this program, and it is that of the War Resister Support Campaign. Now, Kim Rivera is a case that we had been tracking, and I believe we spoke towards the end of last year, just the beginning of this year, and there's a lot to catch up on. So we're going to be speaking with Sarah, who's been involved for a long time in the campaign. She's been a member of the War Resister Support Campaign for perhaps 5 years now, helping out with these various cases that are of such importance to many Canadians. So, Sarah, thanks very much for coming in, and I guess Doug has some questions, and we want to get started looking at Kim's case, so I'll pass it over to you, Doug.
Yes, so, well, we've been, as Brendan mentioned, we've been covering this issue periodically, and this is a long-standing issue because really war resisters started coming into Canada after the American invasion of Iraq, and so there's been a number of U.S. war resisters across the country who have come in over the years, and I think the last few times we've talked, one in particular, Kim Rivera.
That's right.
And she is a U.S. soldier who has a family of 4 children and a husband. And she had a long struggle, I guess, with Canadian officials to try to stay here with her family. And so, unfortunately, last September, I believe it was, the Canadian government sent her back to the U.S. And maybe, Sarah, you can take it from there and describe the sequence of events.
Sure. Kim lost her appeal to stay in Canada on September 17th, 2012. And on the 20th of September, she went over the border and was arrested and put in prison. And was kept in prison until the end of April of this year, when she was court-martialed and pled guilty to desertion. She was sentenced to 14 months in prison, which was reduced to 10 months under the terms of her agreement. And she was given a bad conduct discharge from the Army. She's currently in
the Naval Consolidated Brig.
That's right.
In Miramar, which is in San Diego, California.
That's correct.
You know, as I recall, during our hearings, the I don't know whether it's an adjudicator or a judge was dealing with it, but sort of rejected the assertion that she would be subjected to harsh treatment.
That's correct. They argued that there, in fact, I think the word that the judge used, that there was no evidence, and they said that in fact it was completely subjective that she would be harshly treated or even arrested when she went over the border, when in fact 14 month sentence is in fact a very harsh punishment for desertion. But they have found that American soldiers who talk out against the Iraq or Afghanistan war are more harshly punished than other people who end up in prison who are in the military, either for killing civilians or killing members of their own troops. War resisters are very harshly punished.
So you're saying that if a soldier was speaking up publicly as to the reasons why they opposed the war, perhaps the things they had seen or experienced, things that caused them to change their mind about the war, bringing up these criticisms of the military would subject them to more severe punishment than many other situations?
That's correct.
So really, a soldier that just simply went AWOL would get a much lighter treatment.
Absolutely, yeah. Many who go AWOL, in fact, don't suffer prison terms at all. They are simply dishonorably discharged. But there is significant, voluminous evidence that those that do speak up publicly against those specific wars and the systemic badness, I guess, that's happening there, they do face differential punishment.
Well, it fits in with the larger picture of what we're seeing in the United States generally. I mean, if you'd consider the war resistors as a sort of whistleblower, we know that the Obama administration has unfortunately cracked down on all of the whistleblowers, whether they come from defense or intelligence or their security systems and so on. You're going to end up on the run. I suppose war resistors are not quite whistleblowers, but I've seen the analogy.
I think they are whistleblowers, and I think it's a good analogy because they're reporting on all the grievous crimes they're seeing conducted by the U.S. military in the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. And it really would be contrary to international law for them not to speak out. So they're getting treated harshly for being people of conscience.
That's right. And in fact, in the war resistor meetings, we used to call them our war resistors, our WikiLeaks before WikiLeaks. They were the people speaking about what was happening over there before Bradley Manning and before WikiLeaks.
That's right. There are a form of human intelligence on the conflict.
Right.
And indeed, it was atrocities and things that were witnessed that caused things like WikiLeaks. Bradley Manning had seen videos of the U.S. soldiers shooting civilians from a helicopter and laughing and joking about it. And that had prompted him to release that footage and that evidence and a wide variety of other evidence. So there's more than one person that had leaked such documents for different reasons, but it's what soldiers had seen in many cases.
That's right. A systemic abuse of what's happening.
Just on Facebook, abuse. Right? I was just seeing the latest update, and there was this photos along with an article about rape in the U.S. prisons in Iraq. And there had been photographs of U.S. jail personnel involved in rape and of males and females of Iraqi citizenship. And that had been released or leaked years ago. Within the prison system, there had been that evidence that had been brought to the U.S. Congress or members of the government who then tried at their best to withhold most of that from hitting the public. So actually, this has been circulating. These kinds of releases, this kind of information has been circulating for years, almost since the beginning of the Iraq War. There's so much happening overseas that almost any soldier would witness things that bore into their conscience.
And I really think we have to appreciate the goodness of people like Kimberly Rivera, for the bravery she's shown in speaking out and revealing the horrible things. And that, along with other whistleblowers, I think is necessary to sort of wake up the Western public, not just the American public, but I think Canadian public and other Western nations who have grown tolerant of all these foreign wars. It just seems like we're in a perpetual war state right now. But getting back to Kimberly's case then, so she's now in San Diego in a brig.
That's correct.
And so she has to serve out a 10-month sentence. How is she doing?
She's not doing especially well. She's a very hopeful person and a very peaceful person, but especially when she had to perform military service while she was waiting for her court-martial, even if it's just wearing a uniform, that was hard on her. And then at some point, there was a fund so that her children, her four children and her husband, could spend some time with her before she was sentenced. And their separation was just so traumatic for the children and for her that she's decided that she can't see them, the children, while she's in prison for 10 months, that it would just be too hard. So she will essentially be separated from her family for the full amount of time.
Oh, yeah, that must be really tough. And how's her husband and children doing?
From what I understand, they have a place to live and they're comfortable, but obviously they miss Kim a lot. And there is support for them through Courage to Resist and through others down in the States funding to look after them. So they're doing okay. They have support, but obviously with their mom and wife gone, it's...
These are the kind of sacrifices that the war resisters go through. In terms of their family, that's often the most difficult aspect. There's a separation. There's the part about being in prison. Now, just for our listeners, I know that Kim Rivera's case is second nature to you, but you mentioned help in the United States. I mean, you're sort of dealing with a network here, right? The war resisters is probably a cross-border or international organization.
The war resisters support campaign is specific to Canada, but they do have connections with groups of conscientious objectors or people who support conscientious objectors in the States. The Quakers have been very supportive of Kim, many veteran groups. And so she does have a whole support system down there.
So for us here in Hamilton, are there things we could do to help out?
There are a couple of things. Sometime after Hiroshima Day, which is in early August, the War Resister Support Campaign will have a benefit for, well, the ongoing support of war resisters, not Kim Rivera specifically necessarily, but the ongoing support of war resisters. And most important, the most important thing that we can do right now is to continue to write letters. There have been difficulty with letters being received, but both Kim and others who are currently in prison, who were war resistors who came to Canada, get a great deal of hope out of receiving those letters. So we have two addresses which you can send these letters to, one for Kim and one for another war resister, Justin Colby, who is now serving a 9-month sentence, reduced from 15 months.
And there is a website if people want to send a letter to Kimberly Rivera. It's resisters.ca.
That's correct.
And it has all the information there. So, yeah, we can, I guess, provide moral support with things like letters. And and I understand, too, that financial support is needed because, you know, she has an ongoing legal bills and things like that to cover.
And that's true as well. James Branham, who is her American lawyer, will file or appeal for clemency. And donations will go through Courage to Resist. This is sometime in the near future. He will appeal for clemency on her behalf. And at that time, the War Resister Support Campaign will put up a link to the Courage to Resist fund.
So if I understand this right, we had Kim. She was in the country. She was with her family. The government, our government, agreed to deport her to the United States, where she is now detained under certain conditions, for certain reasons. So it's possible to send her letters for moral support. I understand those letters are important to her. Are they reaching her?
Some of them are. Often they're not. There are many reasons why letters are turned back, whether they're legitimate or not. Apparently, the only thing you can include in an envelope is the paper you write on. You can't include stamps or writing paper or any sort of gift. Only the paper you write on. And if it's not properly addressed, if it's not, if there's a package with it, that kind of thing, it will be refused.
People can get the mailing information from resisters.ca?
They can. I can give it to you over the radio as well, if
you'd
like.
Yeah, we should do that.
Okay. To let her know she has strong support, you can write her at Kimberly Rivera, P.O. Box 452-136, San Diego, California, 92142136. And that's the Naval Consolidated Brig, Miramar, in San Diego.
Okay, so we encourage people to do that. And, you know, besides the terrible situation that Kim Rivera and her family are in, we have other war resisters in Canada and in this area. And there's one in particular, Jules Dungan.
That's right.
And there's been an interesting development in his case. Can you tell us about it?
I can. Jules came up as a resistor to the Afghanistan war. And he, on appeal, he was told that he could appeal to the Immigration and Refugee Board for another hearing. And this is a really important decision because many of the reasons that Kim was forced to go back to the United States, this decision overcomes every argument in the government's case to send Kim Rivera back. And had this decision come in August, rather than in February, perhaps Kim could have stayed. But as it is, this this decision, there are 3 points in this decision that make the chances of war resistors staying in Canada much more likely.
Wait, so you're saying this person benefited or received some kind of different decision than Kim did?
Yes, there's it's not a different decision so much as, I mean, it is a different decision, but it's so much as a development in our case law, that the judge who presided over Tindungan versus Canada, or the Immigration and Refugee Department, determined that in the case with Jules Tindungan, that he is allowed to appeal to stay in Canada for 3 reasons. And those 3 reasons were the reasons that Kim was sent back. So
you mean Kim was trying to stay in Canada based on certain reasons?
For example, yes.
And it was accepted in this person's case?
That's correct. And would have been, had this decision come forward earlier, it might have helped Kim's case as well.
Right. How did it happen that this decision came forward? Do you have like a, you're part of this legal campaign?
Well, we have an excellent lawyer. And part of it, too, is what judge you get sometimes. It's not an ideal system. But it means that now that we have this decision, any decision that comes after this decision will have to consider this decision made in Tindungan versus Canada.
Right, so it set a precedent.
Yeah. It set a precedent, yes.
Yeah. And I think the core of the decision was that the judge found that the court-martial system in the U.S. is not an independent, impartial tribunal as required under Canadian and international law.
That's one of the 3 points.
It's really unfortunate that the hearing that Kim got was not quite as enlightened. In fact, they just seemed to ignore all this evidence.
That's precisely what happened. They do in previous. I mean, there have been many positive decisions. I think there are 8 altogether positive decisions for people who have applied for refugee status as conscientious objectors in Canada with the Iraq War. But this is the first one that, well, we hope will be taken into account when other decisions are being made going forward.
So this might help other war resistors in the future.
I certainly hope so.
Yes. Yeah, we certainly do hope so. And there's another war resistor who recently went back to the States, Justin Colby.
That's right. Justin was in Canada, I think, since 2007. And he has 2 Canadian children and a Canadian wife. And he decided that he doesn't want his children to have to be separated from his extended American family, so he went back to the States and to certain arrest and was sentenced to 15 months in confinement, which was a very harsh sentence and was which was subsequently reduced to 9 months.
Right, this guy went back voluntarily?
He went back voluntarily. He wasn't forced out by the Harper government. It was for personal reasons that he went back. And
okay, because, you know, Kim, I mean, yeah, the government did step in.
The government sent her back, yeah.
But this guy, he just crossed the border.
Yeah, he's crossed the border mainly for his family. He said he thought he should, he wanted to take responsibility for his actions, as he put it. And he didn't want to be separated from his extended family.
And you know what's going to happen when you cross the border, right? You're going to get arrested.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes, unfortunately, that's the case here. And, you know, I've often thought about the comparison even between the American military and the Canadian military. Like, we don't have any counterpart, you know, of Canadian soldiers fleeing Canada, mainly because if you're in the Canadian military and you don't want to serve in Afghanistan, you don't have to serve in Afghanistan. In fact, they get volunteers by giving them big financial bonuses for doing so. So it's a totally different approach. And if you don't want to go back to Afghanistan, no one forces you. So the U.S. military is quite draconian. You know, this phenomenon really shouldn't exist at all in any kind of civilized country where people under the stop-loss measures and so forth are forced to go back again and again to these war zones. And if they don't, they're treated like criminals.
Well, you're dealing with foreign wars of choice here, and the interesting thing is some people have been on three or four tours or deployments. You have people that have been for war for years. They've been at war longer than World War II lasted.
Well, it's interesting what you say about the Canadian military system, because the U.S. military justice system does not meet either international or Canadian standards of impartiality and fairness. And in fact, the Canadian court-martial system was overhauled in the 1990s in order to comply with international standards. The U.S. refused to do the same. And so you have a court-martial system in the United States, which, among other issues, the accuser acts as judge and jury. And that was point one made by the judge in the Tundungan decision. Point two that he made, which will be wonderful going forward for the war resisters in Canada, is that U.S. soldiers who speak out against the war are punished more harshly than other soldiers who go AWOL, much more harshly than even some soldiers who have committed horrific violent crimes. And that means that war resisters are being punished for their deeply held beliefs. So those who speak out about the Iraq war in the military and then go or forced back face not just prosecution but persecution. And that was point two that the judge made. And the third point was that the personal experiences that these people had witnessing the deaths of civilians and violence against people who weren't fighting against them, just of civilians. Those personal experiences were not just isolated incidences that were not condoned by the U.S. and were not systemic. That was not the case. In fact, they were systemic, and there's a lot of documentary evidence that supports that.
That's not what the Harper government was saying.
That's absolutely not. And that was what the government was saying, the opposite. So this judge acknowledges that these are systemic violences, that they will face differential punishment, and that the U.S. military justice system does not meet international or Canadian standards. It's a really important decision.
So that's what they're being sent back to. I mean, it's
that's
almost
right.
Like refugees being sent back to war zones, which we talked about last week. This government loves doing that. Things have changed. I'll get into that. Certainly, this is what war resistors are in for. They know that's what they're in for when they speak out. It does show how much bravery is required to do this. But I was just thinking about what you said, Doug, about Canada and soldiers coming to Canada or from Canada. You know, I was just watching the latest episode of Mad Men, and there was a character. It takes place during the time of Vietnam. One character, their son, was being drafted, and they're trying to figure out what to do. One option they were exploring, of course, was fleeing to Canada. And this used to be a place you could flee to. I wish that was still true. Our government is very intent on deporting people.
Yeah, what a change from some, 45 years ago when we had thousands of war resistors coming to Canada. And I don't recall, there might have been some deportations, but I don't think they were based on them leaving the U.S. military. You know that Canada at that time was a safe refuge for war resistors.
It was. And people will argue and have argued that it was the difference between draft resistance and desertion, but that is, in fact, not the case. There were many deserters of the war in Vietnam that came up to Canada.
Yeah. And this whole term desertion, because all these people that have come here, it's not like they've deserted in the battlefield. This is when they get back to the States and they're awaiting redeployment back to Iraq or Afghanistan.
Right.
So I think it's not a fair characterization of
no.
these courageous people at all.
And they've also done a lot of research and gone through within the military to try to get out of returning to Afghanistan or Iraq and offer to go other places and are sent back to Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's the reason, or would have been sent back, and that's the reason why they can't possibly return, because they just some of them object to all wars, but many of them objected specifically to those particular wars where they were witnessing war crimes against civilians.
Yeah, and especially the case of Iraq. I mean, that's just recognized as a war, an illegal war.
That's the problem. I mean, you've got any of these war resistors are people that had been there to Iraq or Afghanistan, and they saw what was happening, and they didn't want to go back. Most of them had been on some kind of tour of duty.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now you had people like Kim who had to be separated from their family. The government wasn't telling the truth about what they were being sent back to. There's disagreements between judges and our government and so on. We know the stance Harper has taken on this. And we can be thankful that we have this war resistors campaign, because some of the positive effects or outcomes of this have been that war resistors like Kim Rivera and others have been able to spend more time with their family before our government sends them away. They get moral support. You have a lawyer and legal campaign that has right now is preventing some of these deportation measures.
Alyssa Manning. And Alyssa Manning is a brilliant lawyer, and we're very lucky to have her at the War Resisters Support Campaign helping the war resistors.
That's true. And, you know, if you want to give financial support to this, of course, you can get information through the website, which is resistors.ca, right?
That's correct.
That's right. And usually the latest information is posted there. Now, I don't think there's been a big update since about the middle of May, but we have Sarah here who's told us what's happened with Kim and two other resistors. So thanks very much, Sarah, for giving us the latest news on
this
story.
You're welcome.
Thanks. And you should all try to help the War Resistor Support Campaign.